Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday the 12th of August. Today, why the lowest paid workers in the country are being hit hardest by the recession.
Our work has shown really that they're facing a lot of challenges, and those challenges have really been magnified during the recession.
Also in today's programme, how the NHS is being misrepresented by opponents of Barack Obama's healthcare reforms.
Some of the claims that are being circulated about the NHS depict an NHS that not many British people would recognise.
And George Osborne stakes a claim for the Tories as the most progressive party in Britain.
The torch of progressive politics has been passed to a new generation of politicians. And those politicians are Conservatives.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news and today's papers with Bill Overton.
Lord Mandelson is dismissing Tory claims they are the new modernising and progressive force in British politics as a bad joke. Writing in today's Guardian, the business secretary has combined his comments with a personal attack on the shadow chancellor, saying he still has a bit to learn about political positioning. It follows a speech in which George Osborne claimed Labour's policies would lead to cuts in frontline public services. In response, Lord Mandelson, who's deputising for Gordon Brown at the moment, said the Conservatives were not standing on credible ground and repeated an accusation they were taking part in political cross-dressing. The article also reflects a continuing tension between Mandelson and Osborne. Last summer, the pair had dinner together on the Greek island of Corfu, which had repercussions for both of them. We'll hear from The Guardian's political commentator Martin Kettle later in this programme. Around 700 people feared dead following a deadly typhoon in Taiwan have been found alive. An army official involved in the rescue operation says the survivors from four villages made it to higher ground before walls of mud and rock submerged their homes. But many are still missing, with up to 600 feared buried in a mudslide on Monday following rains over the weekend. The death toll since Typhoon Morikot and Tropical Storm Etau cut through Asia has climbed to more than 100, including 63 in Taiwan. More grim evidence of the recession's human cost are expected, with figures showing a further rise in unemployment to a 15-year high. Despite recent signs the recession may have passed its worst phase, the jobless rate traditionally lags behind. The 3 months to May saw unemployment rise by 281,000 to 2.38 million, and experts are braced for a similar scale of increase in the quarter to June. Many experts predict dole queues will stretch past the 3 million mark next year, with an even gloomier forecast from the Centre for Economics and Business Research, saying it could approach 4 million. We'll bring you more on this in just a moment. The chief financial officer of Bernard Madoff's corrupt investment empire has pleaded guilty to 10 criminal charges. It's part of a deal with prosecutors which could unravel the mysteries behind Wall Street's biggest ever fraud. Frank DiBasciali has admitted helping the fraudster run a $65 billion pyramid scheme. The 52-year-old faces a maximum sentence of 125 years in prison, but has agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in return for more lenient treatment. A Brazilian politician who fronts a popular TV crime show is being investigated for allegedly ordering murders in a bid to boost ratings. Former police officer Wallace Souza is suspected of commissioning at least five executions to prove his claim that the region's awash with violent crime. Prosecutors in the remote Amazon city have accused Souza of having links to drug trafficking, death squads and organised crime. He denies the charges, with his lawyers blaming them on a political campaign against him. Now for today's papers. The Independent's take on the unemployment figures is that almost a million of those are under the age of 25, which works out as a fifth of the nation's young people. The headline, young, gifted but jobless. There's nowhere to park extra helicopters in Helmand, according to The Telegraph. A senior officer says only a limited number can be sent to Afghanistan because of a shortage of space. The Times reports Britain facing a surge in drug addiction, alcoholism and domestic violence as the second wave of the recession and rising unemployment take grip. Two smartly dressed robbers are pictured in The Guardian, who are thought to have pulled off Britain's biggest jewel heist, taking gems worth £40 million. The lead in The Mail is how Baby P's natural father is now planning to sue Haringey Council for its failure to protect his son. John Terry's claiming Fabio Capello gives England the extra 5% they need to win next summer's World Cup. That's according to The Express. And The Sun says it's a Brum deal, with Birmingham City finally set to be sold for £70 million. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
The official jobless figures are published today, and they're expected to show that unemployment continued to rise in July in the wake of the economic slowdown. Meanwhile, the people being hit hardest by the recession are those on low incomes. That's according to research published today by the Resolution Foundation, a charity that campaigns on behalf of the low paid. Its chief executive is Sue Regan.
We know that people on low incomes are obviously vulnerable to unemployment at the moment. And the research that we've done has showed that people working in low-earning industries are being particularly badly affected, industries such as retail and services. We also know that people on low incomes are not well equipped to cope with unemployment. They tend to have higher debts, be in poor financial health, don't often have savings or redundancy payments to cushion the blow. We also know that low earners tend to have lower skills. And of course, if you've got lower skills, it's more difficult for you to get back into the labour market. And so, I mean, our big fear is that low earners become the long-term unemployed of this recession.
What kind of jobs are likely to involve the lower paid?
Well, a whole range of jobs. I mean, most sectors have people who are on low pay, but the industries where low pay is highly concentrated is the retail sector. So, you know, shops, the high street, service sector, so leisure and hotels. A lot of the public sector has a lot of low-paid people as well, so people working in social care and health, and indeed there's quite a lot of low-paid jobs in education as well. So a whole range of sectors. You know, and even in something like manufacturing, where people tend to be higher paid, sort of tend to be on above average incomes, because of the size of the sector, there's still quite a lot of low-paid people in manufacturing. We estimate about 1 million people.
And how many people would we be talking about in the UK as a whole?
Well, there's over 13 million households which we term low earners. So that's people who are in work but living on below average income. Average household income in this country is around 27,000. So that's individuals living in those households. So it's it's 30%, nearly a third of the population of the UK.
And what more would you like to see the government doing to help people on low incomes?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that they are recognised. I think a lot of our work has shown that they tend to be overlooked by government, by politics and public policy generally. There's that sort of sense that they're doing okay, whereas our work has shown really that they're facing a lot of challenges, and those challenges have really been magnified during the recession. So I think they need to be recognised, and really what's needed is a coherent strategy for the recession for low earners, which, you know, helps them stay in work, so helps them maintain their financial independence, or if they do fall out of work, you know, programs which help them get back into work quickly, and in particular help them build up their skills, which is really the key to them having, you know, keeping their financial independence over the long term.
Sue Regan from the Resolution Foundation. The Guardian's Stephen Morris has been in Bristol to find out how unemployment has affected people there.
Natasha Cordy.
And how old are you, Natasha?
19.
And so you left school at what age?
14.
So since being of working age, have you had many jobs?
Loads. I've had quite a few.
What sort of things?
I've worked in Hobbycraft, Asda, things like that.
What, on the shop floor?
Yeah. Yeah, never on tills. Worked in opticians. I've had quite a few jobs, but
how come they didn't last very long?
I found I was mistreated a lot, actually, to be honest, because obviously I didn't have a lot of grades in that. Everyone used to speak to me like I was sick, kind of thing.
And you're clearly not.
No, I'm not, honest.
And so, you're unemployed now?
Yeah.
How long have you been unemployed?
A year and five months.
So what's that like?
Horrible. I can't do anything, I can't go on holiday. It's just true, just like any money I get goes on food, because obviously I've got my own place. So I haven't got much of a life, to be honest.
Could you just give me your name, please?
Alex Colbert.
And you're a graduate. Mm-hmm. You've been in work, but are now looking for work. Can you tell me why, if you don't mind?
Well, I'm unemployed, so I wanted a change of career, really. I mean, I was working in a bar after I finished uni. So I was working. And now I want a proper career, really. So that's what
right.
I'm looking for.
So how long did you work in the bar for?
I worked in the bar for about 2.5 years.
What did you study at uni?
I studied computing and economics. So I got a 2-2 in that.
So how come you went to the bar after that? What was the thinking?
Well, basically, it was just it was originally intended as like a just sort of a short stop sort of thing. You know, working the bar until I can find something more suitable for a career, and then obviously move on to that. But I sort of got a bit too comfortable, and then which can happen. But yeah, I got up to be a manager, but it just got to a point where I needed to change my career, really.
Do you think enough chances have been created for young people like you?
Not recently. I mean, when I first left university, when there wasn't a recession, I mean, I think there were quite a few more opportunities in terms of like graduate schemes and what have you. But I think they've dried up quite a lot recently, because I mean, a lot of the jobs I've been applying for, I said that you need like 2 or 3 years practical hands-on experience in like an office environment. So yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, I've been working in the bar, so I don't have that.
Stephen Morris reporting, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, Jonathan Jones on hotels for art lovers, where you can share a room with a work of art or sleep somewhere that a famous artist has once stayed. guardian.co.uk/travel. Jeff Jarvis on his decision to blog about his prostate cancer and the treatment he'll undergo. guardian.co.uk/health. And there's an interview with the Danish chef René Redzepi, whose double Michelin-starred Copenhagen restaurant Noma is exciting foodies with its foraged fare. guardian.co.uk/food. Barack Obama's political enemies are using the example of Britain's National Health Service to attack his healthcare reforms. This television ad is part of a $1.2 million campaign by the Conservative Club for Growth.
$22,750. In England, government health officials decided that's how much 6 months of life is worth. Under their socialized system, if a medical treatment costs more, you're out of luck. That's wrong for America. Life and death medical decisions should be made by patients and doctors, not politicians and bureaucrats. Tell your members of Congress to oppose government-run health care.
Andrew Clark is in New York for The Guardian.
Well, a large chunk of Americans don't have healthcare insurance, so the president's aim is to make sure that everyone has decent coverage of some sort, and that, broadly speaking, involves greater government involvement in healthcare, greater taxpayer money going towards it. So it moves the system very slightly in the direction of a European-style system, although still nothing like the NHS.
And the NHS has been used by opponents of these reforms planned by Barack Obama as an example of how not to do it.
Well, indeed, and I think some of the claims that are being circulated about the NHS depict an NHS that not many British people would recognise.
What kind of things have they been saying?
Well, the most striking comment that's come up recently was from Chuck Grassley, who is the Republican who chairs the Senate Finance Committee and is in a very influential position in looking at this healthcare legislation. And he claimed last week that Edward Kennedy, his colleague in the Senate, who's 77 and who has a brain tumour, would not get treatment if he were in England, because at 77 he would be considered too old and not valuable. Healthcare professionals in the UK who I've spoken to say that's clearly completely false.
And this debate has really, I suppose, put British diplomats in quite a tricky position.
Yeah, I mean, the British Embassy saying that while they would like to correct blatant inaccuracies on the quiet, so having quiet words with politicians and journalists who may say inaccurate things, they really don't want to be seen to be plunging into the middle of a very bitter political dogfight over domestic policy. So there's a delicate balance to be struck there by the diplomats.
And as you say, it is quite a bitter dogfight. I mean, there have been some extraordinary language being used by opponents of Barack Obama.
Well, indeed. And Sarah Palin, who we all know and love as the former running mate of John McCain, really hit the headlines last week when she described Obama's proposals as evil and said that he was going to set up death panels to vet who did and didn't deserve decent healthcare. And she said that her young son, who has Down syndrome, may not have received care under Obama's plans. And she's come in for quite a lot of criticism for the kind of language she used there and for the emotive way in which she approached the issue.
Andrew Clark. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, a chance to get your clothes off and dance on stage in Edinburgh. and it's all in the name of feminism.
At the end of the performance, women in the audience are invited to come and sing that with myself and my co-performer without any clothes on, and we stand shoulder to shoulder and give it all with gusto.
But first, the Shadow Chancellor George Osborne has said that the Conservatives' commitment to public services makes them the progressive party in modern British politics. He says the government's huge debt can be reduced not by cutting public services, but by radically reforming them.
The torch of progressive politics has been passed to a new generation of politicians, and those politicians are Conservatives. By pursuing a course of illiberalism, centralisation, fiscal incontinence and opposition to meaningful public service reform, the current leadership of the Labour Party has abandoned the field of progressive politics.
Political commentator Martin Kettle gives his reaction.
Well, I don't think any political speech that's made in the middle of August is likely to be a game changer. You know, that doesn't happen. We're in the silly season. On the other hand, I think George Osborne feels that the Tories are in a position where they can steal some ground from Labour. They can continue to make the argument that by changing the way in which public services are delivered, they are actually maintaining the principle of progressive support for the poor. And he's really saying that the Labour government is refusing to face up to this question and is therefore going to be put in the position of trying to cut frontline services. Now, some of this is a bit of an argument that you can't just swallow whole, because obviously the Conservatives, like Labour, are at the moment extremely reluctant, with an election just a few months away, to say with very great clarity what they propose to do in terms of public spending. But that argument is going on. It's a big argument for the general election season. And as it were, with Gordon Brown on a holiday, Osborne is coming along and just reminding people that Brown is not saying what he's going to do in terms of public spending cuts.
Is it possible for frontline public services to be maintained, no cuts, but just to save money simply by reforming the way they're delivered?
I don't think anyone believes that that is really true. But spending is at the heart of balancing the budget, and therefore that's got to be partly done by whichever party does it, by a combination of savings and by actual substantive head-on cuts. I think that what Osborne is doing all the time is trying to egg Gordon Brown on into saying first of all, that there will be a need for cuts, which Brown so far is not saying. And if you listen to Osborne's speech and the question and answer session he did afterwards, he's constantly making that argument. And then once he's got him to say that, where the Labour cuts will come. So it's really a war of position that's going on here, because the Tories see an advantage because Labour is not saying what it's going to do. It's having an argument within itself about whether to actually say that there are cuts necessary. And the Tories see an opportunity here, and so they're trying to push the Labour Party into saying what cuts they will eventually have to make. And by doing that, they help to depict Gordon Brown as a dishonest politician, intellectually dishonest politician, who won't tell people the truth.
Interesting, though, as well, that the Tories are trying to steal this mantle of being the progressive party from Labour.
It's amazing to hear a speech from a very senior Conservative, which draws its examples from Bill Clinton's Democrats, from the Canadian Liberals of the 1990s, from the Swedish Social Democrats, and of course from Tony Blair as well. So, I mean, there's a real sense of stealing the clothes of the opposition in the way that Osborne and of course David Cameron does it too, are presenting themselves. That's led Peter Mandelson to say this is mere political cross-dressing and it doesn't amount to anything substantive. And I mean, that will be the Labour counterattack against this argument that it's just trivial politics. It's just show. It's not serious and it's not substantive.
A lot of Tories will be throwing their hands up in horror to hear their party described as being progressive.
The argument about which party is the more progressive, we're more progressive than you are, is an argument about who governs the centre ground. It's all about trying to get voters who read, dare I say, at The Guardian and who might swing one way or the other politically over this question of fairness and progressivism and liberal values to think again about the assumption that they are automatically going to vote for the Labour Party. And clearly, as the polls show and a lot of electoral evidence shows, that argument has had a great deal of success. And obviously, the aim is to make sure that that lands the big prize of the general election victory, which is now only a few months away.
Martin Kettle. Today is the glorious 12th, the start of the grouse shooting season. And as our Scotland correspondent Severin Carell reports, it promises to be a bumper year for numbers of grouse.
I'm in the Lammermuir Hills, about 25 miles south of Edinburgh, and I'm sitting here with Robbie Douglas-Miller, who is the owner of Horsup Clough Grousemuir, which is about 3,000 acre grousemuir in the Lammermuir Hills. And he's also chairman of the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust Scotland. Mr. Douglas-Miller, can you tell me about your own muir? You're quite optimistic about this year, aren't you?
We've been doing a lot of work over the last few years, and it looks like we're going to get rewarded. From the grouse counts, we've got about a 25-30% increase on the previous year. And all of that leads us to believe is that we should shoot somewhere in the region of 300 or 400 brace, which will be a nice upturn for us. Generally, a good year is not the product of just one or two factors. It's usually the follow-on from quite a few years of hard work. And in the last 5 years, we've seen a resurgence of interest in grouse moor ownership and grouse moor management in large parts of Scotland. And the hard work that the owners and the keepers have been putting in over that period of time, combined with good weather conditions, good breeding conditions this spring, I think have paid off.
Come on then.
I'm with Ian McCall, who's the director of the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust Scotland. Why do so many people bother to do this? Why is it so important to Scotland from your point of view?
Well, I think the best analogy I can draw it is to being a vegetable gardener. Many of us love growing our own vegetables, but if we went and costed it, not just in terms of tilling the soil and everything else, but all the problems there are with that, we really wouldn't bother. We should go straight to the greengrocer. But there is a huge pleasure in managing nature and producing a surplus of grouse, and we just accept that it doesn't happen every year. And in order to enjoy a really good year, you have to tolerate a few bad years to know the difference, if you know what I mean. I've always said that if fishermen caught fish every day, they probably wouldn't go fishing. It's that rare and wonderful opportunity when you get a fish that makes it all that much more special.
Ian McCall from the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust, ending that report from Severin Carell. Now, if you've never danced naked in front of a large audience, now's your chance. Trilogy, performance artist Nick Green's show on the Edinburgh Fringe, is a celebration of feminism and of the female form. And to that end, she aims to recruit 150 women to cavort in the All Together.
It's an epic three-part performance event, which I describe as an interrogation of what it means to be a woman living in modern society. And to do that, I use a number of devices or ways of understanding. In part one of Trilogy, this sees the creation of a women's community, a local women's community, who dance a naked ensemble choreography together, which aims to celebrate the difference and diversity between all of those women.
These are local women that you've recruited before the performance?
That's correct, yeah. They're local women from Edinburgh, and there'll be four different groups of women participating in the performance throughout the run. Part two is a performance response to the 1971 feminist panel discussion, Town Bloody Hall, which was a kind of monumental moment in women's liberation.
Why was that particular panel discussion so important to you?
It feels like a long time ago, but most of the things that are being talked about seem to resonate so strongly with how myself and, you know, other women, it just seemed very rich for us as a company, as young people of our time who are kind of engaging in the process of changing ourselves and in the hope that things outside ourselves will change in the hope that things in the world might begin to change ever so slightly. So,
and then the third part of the trilogy, there's more nudity, this time featuring female members of the audience singing Jerusalem.
Yes, well, if they feel so inclined, yeah, there is the invitation to do that. The third part starts with a lecture on the significance of Jerusalem with relevance to the women's rights movement. Of course, it's very popularly known as the Women's Institute anthem, and was also really widely used by the suffragettes in times of protest. So, yes, there's a lot of significance on that song, and yeah, that's right, at the end of the performance, women in the audience are invited to come and sing that with myself and my co-performer without any clothes on, and we stand shoulder to shoulder and give it all with gusto. And everyone else who doesn't want to do that is invited to sing it with us in solidarity.
Unfortunately, it's quite unusual in 2009 to see such an overt celebration of feminism, which, you know, for many people is a sort of old-fashioned and, you know, rather sort of derogatory term for some people.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I feel like feminism is such a dirty word amongst young women, and I spend quite a lot of time with young people working in different ways, community work and such like, and feminism is certainly not a part of any of their vocabulary, and they would shudder to say the word. For me, I feel like this process of making this performance has in fact been a journey of me understanding what that word in fact means to me as an individual woman. So what is my feminism, and how do I find that, and why is it different from 1971, and what's similar about it, and how is it different from my mother or my best friend or my grandmother? And I think it's really, for me, about an individual politic, and that's what feels missing to me in the way that people interpret the word feminism. I think people think it's very specific, and actually I think it's a great platform of creative and radical thought.
Nick Green. Trilogy is at the Arches at St Stephen's in Edinburgh until the end of the month. Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.